Let's hear from the Word of God. Let's spend some time in God's Word. We're going to take Acts chapter 25 this morning, and maybe not all of it. We'll get as much of it as we can. We are following along with the Apostle Paul at the conclusion of the third missionary journey in chapter 21. And I think if it was up to Paul, he would have made that visit to Jerusalem, and then he would have headed back up to his home church in Antioch of Syria. But that was not the way it went for Paul. He did not leave Jerusalem a free man. He was arrested. As you know, if you've been with us in these studies, he was arrested and ultimately in protective custody, taken up to Caesarea in Syria, and eventually Rome. He's going to be taken to Rome as a prisoner. He spends, for the most part, the rest of his life at this point in prison. Between chapters 24 and 25, Paul has been in prison, kind of, sort of. Again, it's protective custody in Herod's Praetorium there in Caesarea. And that was for a space of 2 years. Felix was the governor of that region during those 2 years. That region included Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria, Syria. And during that time, Felix and his wife Drusilla, and this is what we covered last week, had plenty of opportunity to talk to the Apostle Paul about what Christians believe. They had a lot of conversations with Paul, and quite a privilege to have that kind of access to probably the greatest Christian preacher of all time, except for Jesus himself, the greatest theologian of all time, except for Jesus himself. But though Felix was moved by the Holy Spirit, that did not move him to make that decision and accept Christ as Savior. His wife Drusilla did not either. And that is unfortunate because just several years after Acts chapter 24, both of them would end up dying the very same year. Felix's wife, Drusilla, she was actually visiting Pompeii for a shopping trip in 79 A.D., can anyone guess what happened to her? That's when Mount Vesuvius erupted. She was there shopping. You talk about dumb luck. She was shopping when Mount Vesuvius erupted, and her son were both turned to ash. And again, Felix died also that very same year. So the moral of that story is that shopping is very dangerous, ladies. Avoid it at all costs. Now, the moral to that story would be that we are not guaranteed a long life. We don't know how long we have. We aren't even guaranteed to wake up tomorrow morning. So if God sends you a Paul with the gospel message, then don't be a fool. Give God your ears. And then once you hear that message, give God your heart. That is the difference between an eternity in heaven as opposed to an eternity in hell. That's a decision you just don't want to put off. You don't know how tomorrow is going to go. Now, we read in chapter 24, verse 27, that after 2 years of Paul hanging out there at Herod's Praetorium by the beach as a prisoner, kind of, but a guy that had a lot of freedom, it was at that time that Felix was replaced by a man named Porcius Festus, or Porcius Festus. Porcius means pig. Now, I know you're going to think that's just another really bad Arlen joke, but that is true. Porcius means pig, and Festus means festival. So this guy's name means pig festival. Sounds like a guy that would fit right in at the Fayette County Fair, right? Definitely a 4-H guy. He's pig festival, pig party. So he was 70 years old when he took over for Felix, and he would die just 2 years later. By all historical accounts, he was a pretty good man. He was an intelligent man. He was a kind man. He was a gentle man, a gentle ruler. He was a person of action, and in most cases, he really truly did try to accomplish justice in the Roman legal system. Although he is going to miss the mark here in Paul's case, of course, because Paul is a dung magnet. That's the Christian way to say that. He's a dung magnet. Like anything bad that could stick to Paul would, and the guy just never caught a break. If something was going to go wrong to someone, it was Paul. I have a son like that. He would agree with that. Dung magnet. If it can go wrong, it's going to go wrong for Wesley. If you're wondering, Festus took over for Felix because Felix was fired. Now, this is not recorded in the Bible. You won't find it there. You have to look in secular history for this. But secular history tells us that during Paul's 2 years there in Caesarea, an uprising broke out, a scuffle between Jews and Syrians, Jews and Gentiles, there in that city, Caesarea. And Felix, who was prone to abusing his power, went way, way overboard in trying to quell that scuffle. He ended up having thousands and thousands of Jews robbed, imprisoned, and killed over that scuffle. Now, the Jews weren't going to just sit back and take that. They weren't going to let that slide. So they sent a delegation up to Rome to protest Felix before the Caesar of Rome. And when the Caesar of Rome heard what Felix had done, he called Felix back to Rome. So he recalled Felix. He got him up there to Rome. And he withdrew his position from him. He fired him. Now, anyone else would have been executed for what Felix did. But if you remember from a previous study, Felix was actually a childhood buddy of the Caesar at the time, Claudius, him and his brother, Paulos. So he gets a pass. He's not executed, but he does lose his position of power. So Festus is now in his place, Pig Festival. And job number one for Pig Festival is that he needs to try to clean up Felix's mess. He needs to first repair relations with the Jews. He needs to restore law and order to the region. He needs to bring a resolution to anything that Felix has left undone at his departure. And, of course, that brings us to Paul. Paul is one of those pending Felix cases. Paul's been sitting there for 2 years. Felix had nothing on Paul. Couldn't figure out why in the world he was even there. He knew that Paul was innocent, but instead of doing the right thing and releasing Paul, he didn't want to infuriate the Jews, so he kept Paul there. And that's one of the first cases that Festus is going to deal with. He's sort of pressed into the issue. And so we'll begin reading in verse 1. We barely have time to get started. Verse 1. Now, 3 days after Festus had arrived in the province, he went up, which is actually down south, to Jerusalem from Caesarea. Again, Caesarea was the Roman capital for that region of the world. From Caesarea, whoever the governor or procurator was, they would stay there right in the praetorium, Herod's praetorium, and that's where they would rule over that region from. But as we read in verse 1, upon assuming command, Festus doesn't hang around Caesarea for too long at all. Only 3 days later, and he heads down to Jerusalem, no doubt for diplomatic introductions. He's going down there to schmooze the people in the town. He's going down there to meet the religious leaders, the rulers of the area. He's going down there to say, I'm the new sheriff in town, essentially. I'm replacing Felix. I'm in charge. I'm your new ruler. Pig Festival had come to Jerusalem, very unkosher. Verse 2, and the chief priests and the principal men of the Jews, so the chief priests along with the high priest and elders, members of the Sanhedrin, laid out their case against Paul, and they urged him, verse 3, asking as a favor against Paul that he summon him to Jerusalem, because they were planning an ambush to kill him on the way. Verse 4, Festus replied that Paul was being kept at Caesarea and that he himself intended to go there shortly. Verse 5, so, said he, let the men of authority among you go down with me, and if there is anything wrong about the man, let them bring charges against him. So, how long do religious grudges last? Sometimes an awfully long time. Sometimes religious grudges can last for an entire lifetime. It has been 2 years since the Sanhedrin or the Jews in Jerusalem have had to deal with Paul at all. They haven't heard a peep from this guy for 2 years, but 2 years later, they are still just as incensed about Paul's existence and just as filled with hatred for the life of Paul that they are still demanding that Paul be put to death. They try to trick Festus into moving Paul down to Jerusalem, but they don't ever intend for there to actually be a trial because they intend to have him intercepted and executed along the way as he's making his way from Caesarea to Jerusalem. This was the second plot on Paul's life since Acts chapter 21. You remember the first plot? There were over 40 Jews, unbelieving Jews, that hated Paul so much that they took an oath. They said, we're not going to eat or drink anything until Paul is dead. So I would imagine their stomachs are really growling right now, 2 years later. No, I think they probably broke their oaths and ate and drank food. They wouldn't have made it through the week. But 2 years later, that grudge is still going strong. It is sad, to say the least, to see leaders of the Jews' religion so possessed by hatred and bitterness against Paul that they just weren't seeing the big picture. And it's the same picture that we saw from Felix and Drusilla, these religious leaders that are investing all of their time and energy into killing Paul simply because they disagree with him doctrinally and had no idea how short their lives were truly going to be. Here's the religious leaders obsessing over Paul. This is what they're investing their time and their money in. And the truth is that just a handful of years after this, 70 AD, what's going to happen? Titus is going to push into Jerusalem with the Roman army, and he's going to completely destroy Jerusalem altogether. So over 1 million people died in that. Lots of Jews died. If these religious leaders did survive that destruction, well, they've lost family members, they've lost friends, they lose their temple, they lose their religion as they know it. Truly, Judaism never recovered from that. Not nearly the same as it was prior to that 70 AD destruction of Jerusalem. So all of that is just to say that here's the big picture. Don't take yourself too seriously in life. Don't take this life too seriously. Because you're not going to be on this earth for very long at all. You might not even wake up tomorrow. You're probably not going to get 100 years, even if it's stretched out. So shouldn't your concern be about the next life and not about this life? Isn't that the reason Jesus taught us stuff like, don't worry about what you're going to eat today. What are we going to eat today? Anyway, don't worry about what you're going to eat. Don't worry about what you're going to put on. Don't worry about what you got to do tomorrow. Don't worry about those things. It's not what life is about. Life is about eternal things. Life is about the next life and the things that are going to help you in that regard. So does it help you in that regard to spend all your time and energy driving home the axes that you're grinding against the people that you're mad at? The religious grudges that you're holding, the family grudges that you're holding, are those things really worth that? Is that going to help you in the life to come? Is that something that you really want to stand before the Lord with at the judgment seat? I don't think it is. Those kind of things aren't going to help you on the day of judgment. They're not going to help you with the next life. You're thinking very short-sighted when you let things like that exist, and that becomes the focus and preoccupation of your mind and your heart. Wisely, Festus decides here, no, we're not going to move Paul from Caesarea to Jerusalem. That's not going to happen. I'll be leaving for Caesarea soon, so if you'd like, you can come on up to Caesarea. We can hash it all out up there. You can talk to Paul. We'll get his side. You can give your side. We'll have a trial and all of that, but no, we're not moving Paul from Caesarea to Jerusalem for a different trial among the Jews. To be truthful, that actually wasn't something that Festus would even have the authority to do, because it was Roman law that a prisoner that was standing trial before Rome, they could not be cast off to a different ruling body, nor could there be lateral movement or lesser movements with trials and cases. The only thing that a ruler like Felix could do with Paul's case is elevate the case, kick it up to the Supreme Court or to Caesar himself. But you couldn't do any of the lateral stuff or the lesser stuff without the either the request or the permission of the Roman citizen. The Roman citizen that was being tried. That was all just a part of having Roman rights. Verse 6, after he stayed among them not more than 8 or 10 days. So 8 or 10 days there in Jerusalem, schmoozing the leaders, making political relationships. It's all just political posturing here. We all know the truth, and the truth is that they don't like each other at all, but they need each other's support. So they're building these political relationships, which are not real relationships. It's the, you know, you scratch quid pro quo stuff. You know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. I need your support and all that kind of stuff. And it says, he went down to Caesarea, and the next day he took his seat on the tribunal, the judgment seat, there in the praetorium, and ordered Paul to be brought. So Festus wasted no time in hearing Paul's case. No doubt he could tell that those ever-powerful religious leaders were agitated. And then on top of that, we'll see in verse 7 that the religious leaders actually followed Festus back to Caesarea. So like Festus arrives that night, the religious leaders are there too. They probably even beat him. Like, yes, we'll come to Caesarea to try Paul again if it means we've got a shot to get that guy executed. So they were serious about this. Festus knew that. This case gets pushed right to the top. And the very next morning, the trial begins. Verse 7. When he had arrived, when Paul shows up for the trial now, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him. Notice this. That they could not prove. So again, I shared this with you last week. They had plenty of damnable accusations, but no damning proof. Plenty of very terrible things to say about Paul, but not a shred of evidence behind it, not a witness to come forward and say, yes, I heard Paul say that. Yes, I saw Paul do that. So they are hearsay witnesses. And you just know that case is going to get kicked out. Hearsay witnesses don't stand up in Roman law. They don't stand up in American law. Now, I will say this. Roman officials, Roman rulers, were usually very corrupt individuals, but they really did try to accomplish justice because Rome's justice system was very good, very fair, and very thorough. And the punishments for injustices in Rome were very severe. So these corrupt politicians that ordinarily might make some really bad injustices, some really bad judgment calls, knew that they were very much bound to Rome's laws and the accountability of those over them. The people at the top were taking this stuff seriously. You know, if the Supreme Court in Rome heard that you as a ruler had landed on a very unjust decision in a case, unjust, I guess is the word, then you were in trouble with Rome or the Caesar or, you know, the Supreme Court or the Caesar. I'm not sure if I said both of those the first time, but there was accountability at the top. Corruption all throughout the rest of it, but there was accountability at the top. Corruption at the top as well, but accountability to a very good legal justice system. And this reminds me a lot of America, because America is very much the same way. We have a very good legal system. It's very fair. It's got a lot of checks and balances in it to try to arrive at justice for every person. Now, it is a little soft. It is a little weak in many areas because there are a lot of loopholes that tend to let criminals go free. We know that. That infuriates all of us. But all in all, it's a pretty good system. And those ruling in that system, if they've got people above them, people at the top that they are answerable to, that are going to hold them to the code of the law, then you're going to get rulers, you're going to get judges that are trying to accomplish justice, regardless of whether they're corrupt in their hearts or not. The problem with America, I'm about to tell you something you never knew or never would have imagined. The problem with America is that we have reached the point where the people at the top, yes, I'm going to go on record saying this, I probably won't be here next week, that the people on the top are just as corrupt as those anywhere else in the justice system. And everyone's got their hands in everyone else's pockets. And deals are made backstage. And we've got to the point where we can't even trust that the people at the top are holding all of this to justice. Now, I feel like I have to mention the Trump case. I'm not up here saying one way or another how you should feel about Trump. I don't care if you like the guy or you hate the guy. I can understand why you might arrive at both. But either or, I should say. But the truth is, regardless of how you feel about the guy, don't you have to agree that the recent ruling against him was an absolute witch hunt, to use his own words? Did you follow that case? This case was assigned to a judge, Manhattan judge, Arthur, and I'm not sure about how you pronounce his last name, but Arthur Engoron. And this guy, I'm telling you, he is a weasel. Corruption at the top level. He actually telegraphed this. He all but told you what he was going to do months and months before the trials ever started. He told you, I'm not like other judges. And he essentially told you, no matter what the evidence may be or may not be, I'm going to find this guy guilty. I mean, he just completely telegraphed his move. He was going into this case, and when it was over, Trump was going to be guilty. So he convicted Trump of business fraud. And do you know what Trump was actually guilty of? Here's what he was guilty of: appraising his business wealth and then submitting that to the bank, his lender, and then having the bank send their own appraiser to go out and appraise Trump's wealth and then offer him an amount of money. You see a problem forming here? That is a checks and balance system. The crime would be if Trump did something that defrauded the bank, right? Well, here's what Trump did. He said, here's what my business is worth. And the bank that was going to lend him the money came out. They did their own appraisal. They said, here's what we think it's worth. And here's the money that we're going to offer you. And that was the business deal. That was the business deal. Is that a crime? I sure hope not, because that's how the rest of the real estate world and the financial loan world works. You get your appraiser, they come out, they look at your house, they say, here's what we think your house is worth. You take that to a bank, you say, here's what I think my house is worth. What does the bank do? They send their appraiser, they send someone that they trust, and the appraiser gives them an appraisal. Usually there's multiple appraisals, and eventually, the bank has to get to the point where they understand that the appraisal is correct. And then they offer you the amount of money that they feel comfortable with. And when they offer you that amount of money, you're not taking advantage of them. They're saying, we feel good about this transaction. And the really funny thing here is that Trump was, well, this part isn't funny, but he was fined $354 or $355 million. He was banned from operating a business in New York for 3 years. And so questions like, what's going to happen to Trump Tower? What's going to happen to all of his buildings? What's going to happen to all of his business deals there in the city of New York? And potentially these rulings by this judge, this weasel, would pretty much destroy Trump financially. This would be tough for him to recover from. This is not just the $354 million fine. This is shutting down his New York businesses. This is big for the guy. But Trump is going to appeal that ruling to the Supreme Court. And of course, we know what's going to happen. It's going to get overruled, because even the people on the left are saying this is way overkill. There's no precedent for something like this. This is absolutely insane. So what's going to happen is it's going to get overruled and everything. But here's the funny part. They had the directing manager for the bank that loaned Trump the money. They had him actually come forward and speak during the trial. And he told them straight out. He said, hey, we did this the right way. He gave us his appraisal. We appraised it ourselves. We felt differently. We felt like his appraisal was high. So we gave him our appraisal. We offered him the amount of money that we felt good about. And we still feel good about that. He said, we urge you to drop the case. And then he went on to say, we're actually looking forward to doing business with Donald Trump in the future. And what does the judge do? He decides, nah, he's still guilty because I want him to be guilty. Now, how do you get away with that? It's the same kind of thing that you know, the same kind of situation really that Paul is dealing with. And luckily for us, I'm hoping the Supreme Court catches that. I'm sorry to go into, I know this is a Bible study and not a Donald Trump defense, but do you see the problem with how corruption can be? Here's this judge. He's a person of power. He's corrupt in his heart. You can't tell me he's not. He's corrupt in his heart, and he's making a decision based on his feelings, based on his bitterness toward a man, based on his grudges. It's the same kind of thing that the Jewish religious leaders are doing to the Apostle Paul. He's done nothing wrong. He's been by the book, and he's going to say that in just a second. He's done nothing wrong at all. And yet, in their eyes, he's guilty and deserving of death. Verse 8, Paul argued in his defense, neither against the law of the Jews, so that's Jewish civilian law, nor against the temple, that's religious law, nor against Caesar, that's Roman law, have I committed any offense. Check any religious or legal system that you want. You're not going to find a single a single law that I have violated, Paul says. Completely innocent. Didn't do at all what they're saying that I've done. Verse 9. But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, there's some of that political schmoozing and political relationship building coming into play. Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, do you wish to go up to Jerusalem and there be tried on these charges before me? You believe that? He's asking Paul, hey, is it all right if I ship you down to Jerusalem and let the Jews judge you, the religious leaders there in the religion of Judaism? Would that be okay with you? Well, of course, Paul's going to say, are you kidding me? I'll be dead before the day's out. No, that's not going to happen. And it's pretty alarming here to see Festus want to do a favor to the unbelieving Jews that want Paul dead. You know why that might be? His situation is very similar to one of the former procurators or governors over this region, a guy by the name of Pontius Pilate. Maybe you've heard of him. You see, the Jews had Pontius Pilate by the throat. During the ministry of Jesus, Pontius Pilate had committed two pretty grave errors involving the city of Jerusalem. Both of them involved riots, and Pilate's mismanagement of the situation got him warnings from Rome. The Caesar had told him, that's two strikes, buddy. One more and you're out. So Pilate knew, he absolutely knew, that the next mistake he made, that all the Jews would have to do is do a demonstration in the city of Jerusalem, and the Caesar would probably take his job, if not his life. He was in a situation where he was pressured to do something that he didn't want to do. Pilate knew that Jesus was innocent. He tried it over and over, didn't he? I've tried this man. I can't find anything that he's done wrong. He's without fault. How about if I release him? And everything that Pilate tried to do, the unbelieving Jews there in the city of Jerusalem revolted against it, threatened violence, and ultimately Pilate got pressured into the point where he felt like he had to do the unbelieving Jews a favor. Festus is in the same situation. You already know his story. I shared it with you in the introduction. He's taken over for Felix, who has just made an absolute disaster in the city of Caesarea. And he's there to mend relations. He's there to restore order. The last thing Festus wants is a Jewish demonstration in the city of Caesarea or Jerusalem for that matter. The last thing he wants is a revolt, because he figures if Felix lost his job over that kind of thing, surely I would lose my job as well over that sort of thing. He's got pressure on him. He knows Paul's innocent. You're going to see that. He knows Paul is innocent, but he's pressured into a situation because these unbelieving Jews have him by the throat as well. So, Paul, you want to go to Jerusalem and be tried down there? No way. Not going to let that happen. Verse 10, Paul said, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal. where I ought to be tried. I'm not moving. I'm staying put. Rome is going to judge me, not the Jews. To the Jews, I have done no wrong, as you yourself know very well. This is an open rebuke, kind of dangerous, an open rebuke of the governor by the apostle Paul. He just sort of lets Festus have it here. Festus, you know full well I haven't done anything wrong. Why are we still playing this game? Verse 11, if then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. If I deserve to die, then execute me, fine. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. Notice Paul is saying, I know my rights. Festus, you cannot make me go to Jerusalem. You cannot move me from this court unless I agree to it. And so Paul says, I appeal to Caesar. Now again, Paul was absolutely right. That was a Roman law. Without a Roman citizen's request or permission, they could not be moved for a different trial that was not an elevated trial of some sort felt necessary by the ruler over them. So when Festus asked Paul if he can unload this case on the Jews, Paul says, no way, not only am I not good with it, but I know that you cannot do it by Roman law legally. Paul knew that he had a better chance of getting a fair trial out of the Romans rather than a trial before his own people, the Jews. So it's pretty messed up, isn't it? When you have to go outside your own nationality, your own family to get a fair trial. I think it's completely fitting with what Jesus said in Mark chapter 6, verse 4. A prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his relatives. You ever feel like your relatives are the toughest on you? Do they beat you up worse than anyone else? Why do they feel entitled to do that? What gives them the right? Flesh and blood? Come on. Yeah, sometimes it's our own hometowns, our own families that can be the harshest on us. And Paul's definitely in that situation. He knows he's got to go over Festus's head. So he decides to play his trump card. Sorry about that. He appeals to Caesar. And that was the right of every Roman citizen, any Roman citizen. If they didn't feel like they were getting a fair shake in a trial, they could say, I want to appeal to the Roman Supreme Court, or I want to go straight to the top. I want to appeal to Caesar. But that is a scary thing, because you don't want to waste the Caesar's time. You don't want the Caesar to be annoyed at your case. And worst of all, you don't want to go before the Caesar and have him find you guilty, because he's going to punish you harder, and he's also a little bit agitated to have to see your case. So this is a big thing, especially when considering who the Caesar was at this time. The Caesar in Rome at this time is a guy by the name of Nero. Now, I know I'm really quick to vilify some of these people in the scriptures, but I'm telling you, there's no possible way of over vilifying this guy, Caesar Nero. He was an absolute madman. His name is synonymous with some of the world's most infamous leaders of history. Names like Antiochus Epiphanes and Caesar Nero and Attila the Hun and Genghis Khan and Mao Zedong and Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, Tammy Kerner. The worship team knows what I'm talking about. No, I'm kidding, Tammy. We love you. And not just because the Bible tells us that we have to. We love you. So this guy is, he's among the list. If you're picking the top three, the top five, I think you got to discuss Caesar Nero. Paul was going to stand trial several times before Caesar Nero. He shares the gospel with Nero and defends his case before Nero. And Nero ultimately decides to execute the Apostle Paul by chopping off his head. And history records for us that at that time, after his conclusion with Paul there, having, you know, having an attempt made to win him over to Christ, that Nero absolutely loses his mind at that point. He just absolutely goes insane. Most historians agree that the Apostle Paul just absolutely broke this dude's brain. He goes nuts against Christians. He declares the Christian faith as a danger to Roman society. The historian Tacitus tells us that Nero intentionally set fire to a portion of Rome because he wanted to rebuild it. He wanted it to be fancier and better. But he blamed the Christians for it. And man, he went on a quest to kill as many Christians as he could. And between his reign and the reign of Domitian, the emperor that would follow him, Rome ended up martyring around 6 million Christians. 6 million Christians. Now, modern secular historians will try to downplay those figures, but those are accurate figures. Over 6 million Christians put to death by this guy Nero. And we're not just talking about your run-of-the-mill executions, if there is such a thing. We're talking about brutal, vicious, torturous executions. Stuff that you probably can't even fathom, just to tell you a few of the things that Caesar Nero would do. He would take and have sheep gutted, and then he would bring Christians and he would stuff them inside the body cavities of those sheep. He would sew up the body cavities and he would put them in the Colosseum, and then they would turn the lions loose on them. And that guy would sit there and enjoy it as the lions tore into those sheep carcasses and pulled the Christians apart and ate them as they were living. Later on, we find out that Caesar Nero would take Christians, affix them to poles. Don't ask about that. He would affix them to poles. He would dip them in hot wax. And he would set up 1,000 of these human candles in his garden. He would light them on fire. Christians dipped in wax, hanging on poles, to light his garden while he sat there and just enjoyed the situation. You know, just a lovely, calm evening there in the garden of Caesar Nero. He was an absolute whack chop. He was demented, if there ever was demented, and that is the guy that Paul has requested to go to trial before. Send me to Caesar Nero. Oh, I wonder if Paul knew. Verse 12, then Festus, I'll stop shortly here, but let's get a little further. Then Festus, when he had conferred with his council, his legal advisors, answered, "To Caesar you have appealed, to Caesar you shall go." So Paul gets what he wishes, but again, got to be careful what you wish for. You might get it, and Paul gets it, and the heat is on Paul now, because this is no small thing to stand trial before a Caesar, especially Caesar Nero. Festus would be feeling the heat too, and we're going to see that in his conversation here moving forward in the scriptures. Number one, he's sending Paul as a prisoner to Rome, and he has no idea why. He doesn't know what the charges are. He doesn't know if it's legit. He's not convicted. And then on top of that, he's concerned that because this is such a small, trivial case, that when that case is elevated to Caesar Nero, that Caesar Nero is going to say, "What kind of moron did I appoint to this position? What kind of moron do I have ruling down there over the region that he can't even make a determination in a simple little religious spat like this?" So the heat is on him. And you're going to see that. Let's look real quickly. Verse 13. Now, when some days had passed, Agrippa the king and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and greeted Festus. And so, again, this was a political meet and greet. They're up there to introduce themselves to Festus. Obviously, they didn't catch him when he was in Jerusalem. So they're politically posturing here. They're building political relationships. And you'll notice that Agrippa is referred to as the king. He was the king of Israel at this time, but you should know that that really doesn't mean what you probably think it does. The king of Israel from the first century on was nothing more than just a political figurehead. This was just a guy that was essentially a go-between between Roman law and the Jewish civilians. It was done at the behest of Rome in order to kind of acquiesce to the Jews and try to make them feel more comfortable by having a Jew rule over them as a Jewish king, and give them a Jewish king. They thought that might appease them. But unfortunately, Rome did the worst thing you could have done for the Jews. The guy that they picked to be the king of the Jews was not a full-blooded Jew. He was half Jew, and he was half Idumean. So any full-blooded Jew at that time had a problem with that. They appointed this guy that had no business being their king. They didn't like him. And Herod's, all of the Herods, they knew that. So the Herods were always trying to win over the hearts of the Jews by building them big things, by delivering on fancy projects. They were constantly trying to win them. All of the Herods, they were obsessed with Judaism because though they were not full-blooded Jews, they were trying to win the Jews. So they fully converted to Judaism. They studied the religion. They lived by the religion. Well, kind of, sort of lived by the religion. Some of the externals, all of that to try to win the Jews' favor, but it never really did work. Because, again, he's half-blooded. And number two, all of the Herods were raving lunatics. We know that as well. Now, Bernice was Agrippa II. This is Agrippa II we're talking about. Bernice was Agrippa II's half-sister, also his living partner at this time. It was an incestuous relationship. She had several husbands, at least one, before she fell in love with her half-brother. And she fell in love with her half-brother and didn't marry him because that was a no-no even among Jewish culture. Even among Roman culture. And when the Gentiles say, no, that's icky, well, then you know it really is icky. So they weren't married, but they were living together. Verse 14, and as they stayed there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, there is a man left prisoner by Felix. Verse 15, and when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews laid out their case against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation against him. Verse 16, I answered them, that it was not the custom of the Romans to give up anyone before the accused met the accusers face to face and had opportunity to make his defense concerning the charge laid against him. Verse 17, so when they came together here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. Verse 18, when the accuser stood up, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. Verse 19, rather they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who was dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive. So make no mistake about it. In all of the talk about the resurrection in general during these trials, Paul eventually does bring out the full story. Initially, he kind of tried to hold back on the truth so that the whole thing didn't explode. He said, I'm here because I believe in the resurrection of the just and the unjust. Well, that was only part of the story. And that wasn't really the true heart of the matter. But at some point, Paul has got to the heart of the matter that, I'm not just arrested because I believe in the resurrection of the just and the unjust. I'm here because I believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's the crux of the matter. They finally got to the crux of the matter in the case. That's also the crux of the matter for anyone living on this planet in human flesh. By the way, the word crux is a shortened form of the word crucifixion. That's the heart of the matter for every person that is alive. Was Jesus truly resurrected after 3 days of death? Because if he was, then everything he said and everything that he claimed is true. If not, then everything we're doing this morning is futile. It's all in vain. The hinge of all Christianity swings on the reality, the veracity, the validity of the truth of that doctrine, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. If he did, we're saved. If he didn't, we have no hope. We're doomed and cursed creatures forever. Guess what? He resurrected. And I'm alive today, not just in the flesh, but in the spirit, because he resurrected and my sins are forgiven. Verse 20. We're going through this quick because this is just a retelling of the story. And since I took some extra time there with the announcements, I'd like to finish this study out. We won't be long now, and I'll go ahead and cancel the closing song. We'll kind of end abruptly when the study is done, just to spare you a little bit of time. I don't want your beef roast to burn at home. So, verse 20, being at a loss how to investigate these questions, I asked whether he wanted to go to Jerusalem and be tried there regarding them, verse 21. But when Paul had appealed to be kept in custody for the decision of the emperor, I ordered him to be held until I could send him to Caesar. Verse 22. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I would like to hear the man myself. Tomorrow, said he, you will hear him. So here we go. another twist and turn in Paul's trials, you know, in the book of James. The brother of Jesus, James, says, "Count it not strange when you," or no, "consider it all joy when you go through various trials." Well, how about Paul? Paul went through literally various trials, many different trials, many different twists and turns in Paul's case. It's incredible how badly this thing is getting blown out of proportion. He did nothing wrong, but now he's going to be interrogated by Herod Agrippa II. And as you're going to see here, Festus really needs Agrippa. He needs to get Agrippa the situation. He needs to get Agrippa the story. He has no idea what's happening. You know, and Agrippa, he's an expert in Jewish matters. He figures this guy can really help me here. And that's why you're going to see Festus really pour it on thick. I mean, he's going to butter this thing up thick. Watch this, verse 23. "So on the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp. They gave them a grand procession." Truly, they would have rolled out the red carpet for them. That's something that went back to the days of Rome. Rolled out the red carpet, played music, waved flags, celebrating the arrival of this VIP Herod Agrippa II, because they need him. "And they entered the audience hall with the military tribunes and the prominent men of the city. Then at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. And Festus said, 'King Agrippa and all who are present with us, you see this man about whom the whole Jewish people petitioned me, both in Jerusalem and here, shouting that he ought to live, and he ought not to live any longer.'" Verse 25. "But I found that he had done nothing deserving of death." You see that right there? Festus knows he's innocent. Doesn't this sound like Pontius Pilate in his verdict of Jesus? This guy has done nothing deserving of death. I can't figure out a single thing he ever did wrong. I bet the guy never even lied on his tax forms. He is crystal clear. His background, perfect. Reading on, "And as he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to go ahead and send him," verse 26, "but I have nothing definite to write to my lord," Curios, the Caesar, "have nothing definite to write to my lord about him. Therefore, I have brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after we have examined him, I may have something to write." I just find that hilarious. Can you help me? I got to send a letter. I'm sending this guy up there, a prisoner. I have no idea what he did. I can't just write, "Dear Nero, here's a prisoner. I don't know why. Maybe you can get to the bottom of the situation. I'm completely clueless. Don't understand this. Not sure if I should even have him arrested. He may be completely innocent." You cannot send a letter like that to Nero. So verse 27, "For it seems to me unreasonable, I'm sending a prisoner, in sending a prisoner, not to indicate the charges against him." Yep, definitely. You got to have a very good written letter, a very good reason or reasons why this guy is in prison and being tried before Nero. Notice in verse 25, again, Festus concludes, Paul is innocent. So, I just want you to take this in. If Paul didn't shoot off his mouth and say, "I appeal to Caesar," I am pretty certain, I am fairly certain, 90-10, that Festus at some point, probably pretty soon, would have said, "All right, Paul, well, I got nothing on you. I'm going to let you go. Might want to avoid Jerusalem for a while." I'm fairly certain of that, 80-20. You know, somewhere around 70-30, I'm pretty sure of it. But Paul shot his mouth off. He said, "I appeal to Caesar." And that's going to be the death nail for Paul. That's going to put him on the very slow but very definite track to his execution. "I appeal to Caesar." And no mistake about it, Pig Festival, Porcius Festus, he has the power to say, "Paul, that's not necessary. You've appealed to Caesar. I get it. I understand it. But that's not necessary. You're not guilty. I'm just going to let you go." He had the right to do that. So the fact that he didn't do that, it tells you there's something else now that's happening. Maybe it's out of pride or ego. Maybe it's just the fact that Paul has forcefully demanded his rights. You know how that can make our overlords, pardon me, our government officials angry when we say, no, you can't take away our guns. We have rights. You can't limit our speech. We have rights. I think something has ticked off Porcius Festus, because Festus at that point says, okay, you want to go to Nero? Then to Nero you go. And we'll pick up there next week. Would you stand with me? We'll close in a word of prayer. I'll let you out quicker since I kept you longer. If we burnt your Sunday lunch, send us the bill. The board of elders will pick it up. Thank you for your time this morning. Let's pray.